the 25th of August, and this is Rabbi Manning Shiva.
Okay, we have a lot to talk about this morning. This is the 10th and final installment in the Torah Text and Transmission series. And I want to do something today which is probably impossible. First of all, before we actually start the material, I'd like to dedicate the Shia L'Refuah Shelema to Rav Zev Lepp. People might realize Rav Lepp is in need of Refuah Shelema, and his name is Zev Yaakov Moshe Ben Chaya. We daven that our learning should be a schut for him, and all the other Chol Yisrael that need a Refuah Shelema, and they should be well soon and back in action in full. Zev Yaakov Moshe Ben Chaya. So we left it last week in around the year 600-700, and I need to cover all the years from then till now in the next 55 minutes. And we left with an important discussion, which is Chatimat HaShas, the sealing of the Talmud. What do I mean by that? We ended up with a book, this massive book, this commentary on the Mishnah, which is itself a commentary on the Torah, the distillation of the oral law, and we have this Talmud, and that became the only Talmud that we ever had up until today. And we said, why? Why didn't we have a new Talmud? Why didn't Rashi say, time for an upgrade? Why didn't the Rambam say, let's freshen things up, make a new Talmud now? No, they stuck with the old one. Why is that? And we gave a few different reasons at the end of the last share, but the main reason I want to focus is on the Rambam, because we'll start today with the Rambam in a different place. The Rambam said in the introduction to the Mishnayot that the reason that the Talmud was never replaced ad hayom hazeh, until this day, is as follows. It's because the Jewish people collectively accepted the Talmud. It's a Kabbalah. It was an acceptance of the authenticity and the authority of the Talmud. And after that point in time, just geopolitically, the Jewish people were scattered in a way that they could never again come together to accept a new Talmud. Shortly after the Talmud was put together in the 5th, 6th, 6th, 7th century CE, the Jewish people, said the Rambam, were then scattered across the globe in a very significant way. Think about it, the Roman Empire had disintegrated and Europe was then a mess. You couldn't cross Europe in the way that you had been able to earlier. People couldn't move from one place to the next. The Jews were scattered all over the place, to the point that they then began to form new groups, local groups, which we now call Sephardim, Ashkenazim, which before that had been all really together. They'd all been part of the same communities. Okay, there was Eretz Yisrael and there was Bavel, but they are pretty interconnected. Now they were no longer interconnected. And therefore, says the Rambam, we saw this at the end of last time, any based in, any religious authority after the time of the Talmud only has authority over their local community. No one else. So if the Sephardim want to introduce new gezeiras, takanot, new chumras or kulas or whatever it is, they can do that. But the Ashkenazim can look on and say, well, that doesn't affect us anymore. That's not in the Talmud. I gave an example. The Talmud says, the Gemara says, that we should extend the prohibitions of milk and meat from beef and lamb to chicken. And chicken is now also fleshik on a rabbinic level. But it doesn't say anything about fish. Fish is still parrot. Some of the Sephardi communities wish to extend that to fish and say, look, people can confuse meat with chicken, chicken with fish, everything's confusable, let's make fish and milk a new prohibition. So they did, some of them. And the Ashkenazim looked on and said, fine, you can do that, but that's local, you don't bind us, that's not in the Talmud, that's not in the Gemara, we're not bound by that. Similarly, the Ashkenazim can stop eating kidneys on Pesach, and the Sephardim can look on and say, okay, look, you know, that's your thing, whatever you want to do. Some of them were a bit rude about that at the beginning, you should just know. Some of the Sephardi authorities said, like, where on earth does that come from? Others said, no, that's very interesting, you can do that. But one thing is clear, it doesn't bind anyone outside the Ashkenazi community, unless that's their minhag too, because it's not in the Gemara. The Gemara explicitly says you can eat rice on Pesach. Therefore, what we have now is a Gemara and later interpretations, minhagim, which bind local communities. And it's very important because no rabbi today has the authority to bind the world. Leaving aside the issue of Das Torah, which is a fascinating issue, which we had, which we're not here, but in Landa a few years ago, I gave a series of shiurim on Das Torah, which is something maybe we could do today and talk more about, not today, but in this forum. But Das Torah also only affects people who wish to be bound by it. Nobody in the world, no rabbi in the world can say, my tzak, my ruling, my hashkotha binds the Jewish people. You can all say, no, I'm not part of your community, I'm part of a different community, or I'm leaving that community, joining this community, etc. The Gemara, however, binds everybody. So how does halacha work after the Gemara? So basically, the way that we understand halacha today is through the prism of a group of people that we call the Rishonim. And I'm sure this is familiar to many people here. The period between the Gemara and the Rishonim is a little bit of an unclear one, which I'm not getting into. The period that we call the Gaonim, the heads of the yeshivas in Sura and Pompadisa, that wasn't really a time of a lot of halachic development for all sorts of reasons I'm not getting into now. It's an important period, but this is not a history shiur, and I'm not getting into the Gaonim in great detail now. But from a halachic perspective, we now read the Gemara through the prism of the Rishonim. Who do I mean? And I could give a shiur on each one, which would be interesting, but we'll just have to give an overview. Between the year 1000 and the year 1500, let's just use it as a rough period, it's not exactly that, but between those, in those 500 years, you end up with a large group of people. Ashkenazi Rishonim, Sephardi Rishonim, people like, in the Ashkenazi world, Rabbeinu Gershom in the earliest times, but of course the Chayim of Rabbeinu Gershom, Rashi, the school of Rashi, the Tosfos, Rabbeinu Tam, the Riyad Zaken, the Maharam of Rottenberg, the Rosh, the Truma Kadeshen, the Maharil, all those people who are part of that Ashkenazi world. And then in the Sephardi world, parallel to that, you have, through the period I was talking about, the Rabbeinu Hananel, and the Rif, and the Rambam, and the Ramban, and the Ritva, and the Rashba, and the Abarbanel, and all those people are spanning that period. The Abarbanel is probably just at the end of that. We view halacha today through the eyes of those people. They basically understand the Talmuds, the Sugyas, the Gemaras, and push them one against the other, and what we have then is a large number of different commentaries on the Talmud. And from those commentaries, we distill the halacha. How is that halacha distilled? So during that period, it was very simple. As I said, everything was very scattered. And if you lived in northern France, so you understood the Gemara and the halacha through the eyes of Rashi, through the eyes of the Baalei HaTosfos. And that's how I'm going to give you an example. Let's pick the example of how long do you wait between milk and meat. Okay. So the Gemara clearly says you can't eat milk and meat together, even if they're cold, even though that technically is not a Torah prohibition because they're not cooked together. But the Gemara says, no, we don't want anyone eating cold meat, cold cheese, cold milk. That's all separate. In fact, more than that, says the Gemara, you have to wait after you've eaten meat, mis-se'uda le-se'uda, from one meal to the next meal, and then you can start eating cheese and milk. How long is mis-se'uda le-se'uda? The Gemara doesn't, it could have easily put a time frame in, and it chooses not to. So we leave that for people to understand in their own communities. Came along the Baalei HaTosfos and said, well, it's simple, isn't it? Mis-se'uda le-se'uda means not in that meal, in the next meal. So you finish one meal, you have your meat meal, you finish your meat meal, you wash your hands, maybe you wash out your mouth in case there's meat in your mouth, you bench, you clear the table, and then you can have a milk meal immediately. 20 minutes later, 15 minutes later, you don't have to wait any time at all. Just don't eat it in the same meal, and that's the way that the Ashkenazi poskim, some of them anyway, understood mis-se'uda le-se'uda. Parallel to that, in the world of Sfarad, you have the Rambam, who says, no, that's not how I understand mis-se'uda le-se'uda. Mis-se'uda le-se'uda is the time frame from one meal to the next meal. How long is that? And he brings various sources, around 6 hours. And therefore the minhag of psak, if you like, in the Sephardi world became, you wait 6 hours, or into the sixth hour. The Rambam says, kamo sheish shals. And therefore you had two different minhagim growing up as to how to wait, because the Gemara doesn't specify how long you wait, and the different communities waited that long. So if you lived in northern France, that's how long you waited. I don't know, you finished your Shabbos dinner, you eventually cleared up, and then you brought out a cheesecake. Okay, if you lived in Sfarad, you followed the minhag of the Rambam, or the Rif, or whatever, and everyone was happy in the minhag that they had. What happened between the years 1300 and 1500 is very significant for today's share. And this is the introduction I've given. There was relative stability between, let's say, the years 1000 and 1300. Okay, there were the Crusades in Europe, but there wasn't mass movements of people. The Jews in Spain had their golden age through the 10th, 11th, 12th century, which gradually petered out into a not-so-golden age. The Jews in France were relatively secure, and the Jews in southern France, in Provence, and they lived there for hundreds of years. If you took a snapshot of world Jewry, of European Jewry, because really it was only in Europe and Tehran, and maybe in a bit in Russia, in sort of Bukharians, if you took a snapshot in the year 1300, it's a relatively stable picture. The Jews in France have been in France for 500-600 years. The Jews in Spain have been there for 500-600 years. People davened in shuls where their ancestors had davened for hundreds of years. And therefore people, from a halachic perspective, had a certain stability. You followed the minhag of your community and the way they viewed the Talmud. However, between 1300 and 1500, everything went haywire in all the different communities. And without getting into a long discussion of that, in Europe, you had a number of very cataclysmic events. First of all, you had the Black Death, the bubonic plague in the 1340s. This decimated the whole of the European, certainly the northern European communities, the Jewish communities as well. Around 25% of all the Jewish communities died. That is a touch lower than the outside general community. That was more like 33-34%. But even if it's 25%, even if it's 5%, it's a disaster for the community. And therefore whole communities were wiped out. What's more, the disaster that affected Europe, of course, led the outside non-Jewish community to turn on the Jewish community, and there were mass pogroms. And this caused a lot of refugee crises within the Ashkenazi world. If you look at the cities that the Ashkenazi Jews had to go from one to the other, between, let's say, the year 1250 and the year 1500, it's unbelievable how anyone had any stability or roots at all. They went from this place to that place. They were thrown out of England, they were thrown out of France. Germany was 100 little states, and they were thrown from one to the other, then back and out again. And you ended up in, by the year 1500, where nobody had any roots at all. Everybody was everywhere. And one of the directions they were gradually pushed is east. Because you can't go north. Where's there to go north from Europe? Okay? And they couldn't go down to Spain. They'd meet other people coming back up again. So they went east. They went to Poland, to Lithuania, to Latvia, to Russia, to places that really, you know, nobody really lived. They were not part of the quote-unquote civilized world at that time. In Latvia and Lithuania, they were still worshipping trees in the 1300s. And therefore, when the Jews arrived there, they started new communities. That's how my ancestors, who came from Latvia, Lithuania, probably many of yours, that's how they got there. They weren't there much before 1500-1600. They came from Central Europe. At the same time, the Spanish were undergoing their own crisis. The Golden Age was long over. From 1300, 1400, 1500, the persecution was ratcheting up very, very rapidly. 1391 was a key moment where there were mass pogroms in Spain. And of course, eventually, 1492, where the community was exploded onto the world scene, and now it really was a world scene, because some of them went to South America, some of them went to North America, many of them went to Europe, and you ended up, as I said, in the year 1500 with the Jewish world in a big mess.
Egypt,
all over the place. Eretz Israel, and we'll come to that in a minute, there was an aliyah to Eretz Israel. There was a feeling of this must be the beginning of Mashiach. This must be a messianic moment. After the Jews had suffered so badly over the last 100 years everywhere, Mashiach must be nearly here. And there, this is, of course, the growth of the Kabbalists in Sfat and that whole movement with the Arizal, etc., which we'll talk about in a minute. Why am I telling you all this? Because from a halachic perspective, it's critical. Because if you wake up in the year 1500, life's never going to be the same again. You can't just say, what's our minhag? How do we view the Talmud? Who are we? You're not living in a place anymore where you know what your minhag is. You take a town like Belgrade in Yugoslavia, in Dalmatia. It was a refugee hodgepodge. There were people there, Ashkenazim and Sephardim, from Spain and from Europe and from here and from there. You ask people, what's your minhag? I don't know. Oh, we don't know. We've only been here for a generation or two. And we're all different. There's this community and that community. And at that point in history, in Jewish history, it was clear that there needed to be a change. And that's what I'm going to talk about today. Because two people woke up basically in that century and both said, independently at other sides of Europe, the same thing. One of them was Rav Yosef Karo, who was living in Tzfat. He himself was a refugee from Spain. He was thrown out of Spain when he was a small child, age 4 or 5. He then went to Portugal, and he was thrown out of Portugal as a teenager with his family, and he ended up in Turkey, and then he ended up in Eretz Israel. So he was personally acutely aware of the crisis affecting the Jewish people. He had this idea, we need something new, we'll talk about what. And at the same time, Rav Moshe Isserles in Krakow, who also is in a relatively new community. The Jews had only been in Krakow for 50, 100 years, and he also understands that there needs to be something radical and new that has to happen here in the halachic process. And we're going to talk today about what they did and why they did it and whether it worked and how it took off. Fine. In terms of the messianic moment that I talked about before, I want you to look at the Rambam in number 1. The Rambam drops into the halachic system in Hilchos Sanhedrin a bit of a bombshell. And he says as follows. Remember I said to you that according to the Rambam, the reason that we never had another Talmud is because we were scattered. We were disunified and we were all over the world. And if you look at the Rambam in number 1, he gives a solution. The problem he's dealing with is as follows. How are we ever going to get a Sanhedrin back? In order to Mashiach, the Sanhedrin, to give an approval, and we need to kickstart the halachic process, but we need musmachim. We need rabbis with real smicha, with the continuous chain of smicha, where rabbi to student to student to student came from Moshe Rabbeinu. We don't have that anymore. How can you suddenly resurrect that? We lost it in the 5th century. So look at what the Rambam says. Nirin li hadvarim. It seems to me, and by the way, whenever the Rambam starts a halacha, nirin li, or it seems to me, you know there's something interesting, because he's not getting this from a clear source. He's saying this from his own understanding. She'im hiskimu kol hachachamim she'be'eretz Yisrael. If all the rabbis of Eretz Yisrael were to agree, which already is almost a miraculous scenario, okay? Lemanot dayanim, to appoint dayanim, velismochotam, and to give them smicha, hari elu smuchim, then they become smuchim. And I'm not talking about the modern day smicha, which is really just like a certificate that you give to a young rabbi and say, you are now warm enough to be let loose on the unsuspecting public. You know, you are now given a heter, a hegel for a heter hurrah. And by the way, it's interesting, just in parentheses, the origins of the modern day smicha are at the end of the Black Death, of the bubonic plague. So many Jews had been wiped out that they had no rabbis, and people were beginning to be appointed who were really not up to the job, so they introduced some kind of certification process. But this is a far cry from the smicha of old, the smicha that we need. But says the Rambam, you can get back the old, the real smicha, if all the rabbis in Israel agree and they appoint these rabbis, they become smuchim. V'yesh lehem ladun dinei knasos, and they can now do all the things that the real Sanhedrin had to do, the things that modern day Bafei Din can't do. V'yesh lehem lismuch acheru, and then they can give smicha to others. So why were the rabbis so upset that we lost smicha? And that they were upset. We no longer have active halachic processes in knassos, in corporal punishment, all sorts of things. Why, says the Rambam, were the rabbis upset and losing this? I've just told you, you can get it back very easily. Just get all the rabbis together and let them agree in Eretz Israel. So he says again, Lefisha Yisrael mufuzarim, because the Jewish people were scattered. They were all over the place. The Iyesha Yishiaskimu Kolom. It's very practical, just like I told you before, according to the Rambam. Why don't we have these new systems, new Talmud, new Sanhedrin? Because we're just all scattered. The Iyasha Shiaskimu Kulam, we just can't get it together. The Imhaya Sham Somuk, Mipi Somuk, Eina Tzarech Das Kulam. And if we just had the original smicha, we wouldn't need everyone together, but we don't. So we have to get it together again. So if there ever comes a time again when we can come together, we can start smicha. Rav Yosef Karo in Eretz Yisrael in the early 16th century said, now is that time. And he wasn't the only one. You have Rav Yaakov Beirav, many have been to Tzfat, I'm sure, to the Beirav Shul, etc., who came up from Egypt. A group of them, very mystical, Kabbalistic thinkers, said, this is it, let's do this, let's do it now, let's get a new Sanhedrin together. And there was a very big political move in Tzfat, which was a center of Jewish life. They said, look, there's an aliyah to Eretz Israel. This is Hevlei Mashiach, we've just been through Gog and Magog. Look what's happened to the Jewish people in the last 100 years. Now is the time to make a Sanhedrin, let's do it. And they did it, or they started doing it, and they gave smicha to Rav Yosef Karo, who had not just modern day smicha, but they gave him the original smicha, like the Rambam says, and he gave it to others and to others and to others, and they said, this is the moment. Yes. Yes, outside Eretz Yisrael is irrelevant because the Sanhedrin can only function in Eretz Yisrael.
So does that mean that you have to have the Chachamim all come back to Eretz Yisrael?
No, those Chachamim who are in Eretz Yisrael.
Even if they're a miut of all the Chachamim?
So that's an interesting question. Yes, even if they're a miut, because if you look in the Second Temple period, the Jews in Eretz Yisrael were clearly a minority. When they rebuilt the Second Temple, the majority of the community was still in Babylon, in Chutz La'aretz. The community in Chutz La'aretz is, for these purposes, not central. It's not central. Eretz Yisrael is the place. Yes. Yes, we'll get to that in just a minute. He first started the Sanhedrin project, and it did not work, as you know, because we don't have a Sanhedrin today. It didn't work. Why didn't it work? Because there was politics. The rabbis in Yerushalayim, which was, by the way, much smaller as a community then than Sfat, said, hang on a minute, you can't just start giving smicha to people. We're the Rabbanut. We're in Yerushalayim. You can't make your own Rabbanut somewhere else and have breakaway rabbinic groups. This is not how it works. You may hear echoes of this in Harrod. So you can't do that. And there was a lot of toing and froing on this. And in the end, the project broke down. And it did not work. This, by the way, is not the last time that there's been an attempt to make a Sanhedrin. There have been numerous attempts over the years where the Jewish community have felt that we're mamash on the verge of Chevlei Mashiach. After, for example, the Tach V'Tat, when there was the whole Shabtai Svi debacle, there was an enormous messianic movement. Napoleon, 150 years after that, he put together his own quote-unquote Sanhedrin, quite a famous exercise, and he promised the Jews that if they supported him in Eretz Israel, he would help them build the third temple. We have the written proclamation he sent to the Jewish community in Eretz Israel, which of course at that time, in the early 1800s, was under the Ottomans. And they were very conflicted. Who do we support here? Do we support Napoleon, who wishes to come back and start a whole new Geula, or do we support the Ottomans, who are oppressive, etc.? And they have the same conflict in Russia as well. Who do we support, Napoleon or the Russians, etc.? That's a whole other story. And even in our modern times, there have been attempts to restart the Sanhedrin. After the Medina was declared, there were many people who felt that now is the time to have a Sanhedrin. There is even a group of people today who are called the Sanhedrin. They're not the Sanhedrin because they don't have the support of the mass support of the Jewish people. But they have a website. But that's good. Okay, that's already a start. And they're a group of people who are Talmidei Chachamim. There's no question about it. They're bona fides. It's not in question. But they don't have the public support. As we know that a Sanhedrin is measured not just by Godel B'Chochma, but also Godel B'Minyan. A Sanhedrin has to be Godel B'Chochma, but meaning the people have to have the qualities and the qualifications. But also Godel B'Minyan. What does Godel B'Minyan mean? The Sanhedrin was always the same number. It was all 71 people. Minyan means the support of the Jewish people. So we don't yet have a Sanhedrin, and in the time of Rav Yosef Karo, his attempt to make one did not work. However, and this is the very long introduction to where we're coming to, he said, okay, so we'll do something else instead. And it's only when you understand the times and the context of the Sanhedrin that you understand why he said, let's make the Shulchan Aruch. He said, we need to do something new. The Sanhedrin project didn't work, but we still have a crisis. Nobody knows how to paskin. Nobody has any clear Masorah at this stage. Because of the refugee crisis and the oppressions and the pogroms and the killings, etc., we need a new Psak for everybody. Just like a Sanhedrin will be a Sanhedrin for everybody, they're not going to have a Sephardi Sanhedrin and an Ashkenazi Sanhedrin. That defeats the object. We need one book, one halacha, one psak that binds everybody, and I'm going to write that book. And his qualifications to write that book were unimpeachable. He was without question one of the greatest gedolim of the time, and he lived in Eretz Israel. And therefore he said, I'm going to write a book, and this is how it's going to work. Look at number two, please. First of all, he wrote his magnum opus, which is the Bet Yosef. The Bet Yosef was what later became the Shulchan Aruch, when he condensed it into the Shulchan Aruch. I'm going to skip around in source number two. I'm not going to read the whole thing. Look at what he says. Okay. Ani Hadal Baalti. Who am I? The lowest in my tribe, as it were. Yosef ben Moreno Harav Ephraim. Okay, Yosef Karo. Okay, ben Moreno Harav Yosef Karo. His name Karo, by the way, was not from Cairo. He never, as far as I'm aware, went to Cairo. Caro is from Yakar. Caro is a Spanish word, it's a Latin word, meaning precious or dear. Cara in Italian and Spanish, as far as I'm aware, means something like that. He says, I, Rav Yosef Caro, okay, Kinesi Hashem Tzavakot, V'na'er V'ni'arti Chasani L'sakel Hamsila, I've decided to pave a new path, to plow a new furrow over his gamti lechaber, and to get together, to put together sefer, a new book, kolel kol hadinim hanohagim, including all the practical halacha. By the way, that's an important point, because he didn't want to make a book for all time. He just wanted to make a practical halacha sefer. The Rambam's Mishnah Torah is an all-inclusive sefer. The Rambam writes at the beginning of his Sefer in the Mishnah Torah, this was 300 years before the Shulchan Aruch, he writes that I am going to give you every halacha in the Jewish system. From practical halachas to korbanos and tumah and tara and how to be a nazir, everything, how to build a Beis HaMikdash, he brings you everything to the point that the Rambam in his book says that if it's not in my book, you don't need it. That's why he called his book the Mishneh Torah. He says there's now the Sefer Torah, Torah Moshe, Torah Moshe Rabbeinu, which is the Chumash, and there's the Oral Torah, which is the Mishnah Torah, the second to the Torah, Torah Moshe Ben Maimon. So that's all you need. And that got him into trouble as well. The Shulchan Aruch never tried to do that. The Shulchan Aruch says, I just need a practical sefer. That's why not everything is in the Shulchan Aruch. It's not a surprise when sometimes we find things which are not in the Shulchan Aruch. He says, I'm going to write you a practical sefer, the Bi'ur Sharshehem, with all of the explanations of the roots, Umasa'ehem, and how the halachas developed, Meha Gemara, from the Gemara, in Kal, Chiluke, Svaras, Haposkim, Ish, Lot, Ne'edara. I'm going to include everybody, all the Poskim, all the Rishonim, Sfardim, Ashkenazim, etc. I'm going to give you it all on a plate. The Lora Isi Lassel Sefer Zeh Chibu Britney. I didn't want to make this book a freestanding, self-standing book. I didn't want to have to redo everything that has come before and put all the opinions in. Therefore, I decided to write my book as a commentary on one of the existing poskim, Hapur Samim, which were well known. So, who's the most obvious person? If you're going to come along, Rav Yosef Karo, the Sfardi, and write a commentary on another book, whose book is he going to choose? The Rambam. So he said, "Ba'ala b'dasi." My initial thought is l'samcha l'sefer Rambam, to write my commentary around the Rambam, li'osa posek hayosem ufursam ba'olam, because the Rambam is clearly the most well-known posek in the entire world. The Chazar Tibi, but I changed my mind. He said, "Mitnei she'ein maybe el svara achat," because he only ever brings one opinion. Whose opinion? His opinion. The Rambam brings no sources, he brings no machlokas, he just brings everything. That's why the Rambam is so beautiful, so it's so genius, so it's so wonderful to learn. It simplifies, it makes Judaism look beautifully clear, clears all the fog, etc. But at the end of the day, that doesn't reflect the multiplicity of opinions. I would have had to write everybody else's opinion as well. And therefore, his canti, eventually, what did I decide? The Samchol Sefer Arba Turim. I decided to base it on the Tur, Shechiber Harav Rabbeinu Yaakov Ben Arosh, that the Rav Yaakov Ben Harosh wrote about 150 or so years before the Shulchan Aruch. I decided to write based on that because he brings different opinions, therefore he's already done some of the work. And then in the next paragraph, I'm not going to read that through, he tells you all the different books that he's going to bring. He did a massive research job. He went looking for manuscripts, he went travelling around, and he brings it all together. He brings a long list of Rishonim, about 20, 25. He says, this is my standard list of people that I'm going to bring. Then in the third paragraph, he makes a little apology. He says, I'm not going to bring all the Ashkenazi Rishonim, because they kind of summarized a bit later by the Rosh and by others. And that already causes the beginnings of some problems, which we'll talk about in a minute. But he already accepts that he's not going to bring all of the Ashkenazi Rishonim. But I want to skip to where the writing gets a little bit smaller, where it starts the fourth paragraph down where it says, Va'al. Okay, you see this?
Yeah.
1 second. Okay, actually, you know something? Let us go to the next paragraph. I'm sorry, to the fifth one down. L'chein. U'l'chein hiskamti badati. Therefore, I came to the conclusion, ki li'yosh shloshes amudei ha'horah, to pick three major pillars of Psak, Asher Habayis Beis Yisrael Nishan Aleihem Behoraseihem, which the entire Jewish people rests on. Meaning, I have to work out how to paskin the halacha, says the Beis Yosef. And I'm not, in his discussion that we skipped in the middle, he says, I'm not going to get into an argument with the Rishonim. Who am I? Am I going to start choosing between the Rishonim? I'm not going to do that. I'm not capable of doing it, he says. And also, I'm not going to start working out based on Svara and logic, which makes the most sense, because they've all gone through that. You can see all their arguments. I'll set them out in front of you in my Sefer. So how am I going to give you clarity? Because at the end of the day, the book is designed to give clarity. So I'll make a decision. I'm going to take the three biggest poskim. Halohema, who are they? Harif. Haramba, the Harosh. The Rif, Rabbeinu Yitzchak Alpasi, from North Africa in the 11th century. The Ramban from Spain and then North Africa in the 12th century. And the Rosh from Europe and then he went to Spain in the 13th century. So he says, I'm going to pick the Rif, the Rosh, the Ramban. Okay. Amarti alibi, and I said to myself, Shebemokum sheshnai mehem maskimim ladat achat, if I can find that two out of the three agree, nisak halacha kamayim, that's the halacha. I'm going to follow that halacha. Unless there's a very clear fixed menag otherwise that we don't follow this, I'm basically going to go with two out of three. Of course, if you can get three out of three, that's like, you know, hitting the jackpot in Vegas. You know, you get all the cherries lined up, that's it, you're there. If I can get the Rosh, the Rambam and the Ritz to agree, there's nothing to talk about. But even if they don't all agree, if I can get two out of three, that'll do for me. Why? Because you follow the majority. How do we know you follow the majority? Pasuk. That's how halacha works. Achrei rabim lahatos. So if I can get three out of three, matov umanayim. If I can get two out of three, that's the halacha. But if I can only get one out of three, just one second, to go to the next paragraph. Umamakum she'echad min agimel hamudim niskarim loy giladat. When one of the three doesn't tell me what he thinks, Bedin in this halacha, Bedin ahu, the hashnei amudim and sharim cholkim, and the other two disagree, meaning I can't get a majority. I don't have a clear majority, two out of three. But dafra in the matter, hini haramban, what am I going to use then? Look, I've got the Ramban. In other words, I'm going to turn to others. Harashba, Haran, Hamordechi, I'm going to start looking around at other people. Hasmag, Lefaneinu, we have all those as well. Amokam, Asheri, Yushama, Ruach, Ruach, Elokim, Kadishim, okay? Alechad, Nelech, we'll go to them. Ki aladath, Asher, Yitu, Arubam, Ken, Nisakalach. And if we can find the majority in a more, in a bigger consensus, so we'll look at that. But my starting point to this Shulchan Aruch is, Rif, Rambam, Rosh, if I can get a majority, that's a halacha. And basically, unless there's a very clear minhag to the contrary, I'm going to just override everybody else. No one else is going to count in the halachic process. So the lady had a question over there, yes?
Do we know, and this is very counter, but for the Rambam, do we know what his method was?
The Rambam, that's one of the biggest questions. What was the Rambam's method? The Rambam doesn't give any clues to his methodology. And therefore most of the commentaries on the Rambam over the last 800 years have been trying to work out how the Rambam got to the psak that he got to. Very often it's clear, he clearly comes out of the Gemara. But the Rambam goes a lot to the Yerushalmi. That's one of the features of the Rambam. He likes the Talmud Yerushalmi. He uses the Talmud Yerushalmi more than other poskim, and there's a lot to talk about on that. And other places too, the Tosefta, and he talks a little bit about that in the introduction to the Mishnayos. But no, the Rambam is more of an enigma. Again, 90% of the time it's clear, but some of the times it's not. He doesn't show his notes. You know, when you do math, you know, they say you always have to show your working out, because we don't have. So the Rambam doesn't do any of that. He just gives the answer. The Rabbi Yosef Karo says, I'm going to show you all the working out, but at the end of the day, I'm going to paskin like this majority. Yes?
We mentioned many times in the start of the Ashkenazi, the split. When did this occur? Because we haven't mentioned when it occurred.
Okay,
you talked about communities,
right,
of the ether, moving the...
I mentioned that a little bit at the end of last time. It occurred in the late 8th, 9th century. Meaning, as the Jews came out of Babel, they split. The general academic consensus up until recent times has been that the Sephardi world was largely created by the Babylonian split, that the Babylonians, basically the Babylonian Jewish community, spread down through North Africa and followed the Muslims up through into Spain. Okay, and that became the Sephardic community. And the Ashkenazi community around this time, 7th, 8th century, went through from Eretz Israel to Italy. And the Italian community came up from Italy, over the Alps, up into France, Germany, etc. That's been usually the consensus. There are people today in the academic world that question that. One very good person to read, and he writes at great length on this, is Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. In America, Professor Rav Chaim Soloveitchik in YU. His speciality is the historical formation of the early Ashkenazi communities, and he has a lot, books and books and books to say about this, and that's the place to get if you're interested. So the Shulchan Aruch has written us a new book called, and he wrote the Bet Yosef, which is his commentary on the Torah, and then later he distilled it into the Shulchan Aruch, which is just his kind of bullet points, do this, don't do that, do this, don't do that. And now we have a Sefer. And he said, this Sefer is for everybody. Sephardim, Ashkenazim, it's one Psak for the Jewish people. Now, there were basically three reactions in the Jewish people to this innovation. One reaction was, this is fantastic. This is just what we needed. This is exactly what we have to do in this modern time. We need a clear Psak for everybody. Because we can't anymore fall back on our Masorah. Where did my granddad, where did my great-granddad daven? Who did they pass it like? Because they're all over the place. So this is perfect, and therefore the Shulchan Aruch, for that group of people, was accepted very strongly. And especially in the Sephardi world, the Shulchan Aruch was very, very, very well accepted and well received. To the point that very often the modern Sephardi poskim, the Shulchan Aruch is extremely authoritative. I mean, everybody is authoritative. But if you take, for example, the writing of Rav Avadia Yosef, and you look at his Shuvot, the Shulchan Aruch is often very much a central point, a starting point in many ways, of his halachic process. If you're interested in reading an interesting book, also translated into English, is it translated into English? No, it's not. It's only in Hebrew. But the Rav Benny Lau from the Ramban Shul here, his PhD thesis was on the halachic methodology of Rav Avadia Yosef and how that connects in with Rav Yosef Karo. He calls it Mimaran as Maran, okay? And if you're interested in a bit of looking into the great detail of how this works, that is a book that you can pick up in Hebrew. It's not expensive, and it has a lot of fascinating chapters on how the modern Sephardi Psak of Rav Avadia, by the way, Rav Avadia is not the only Sephardi voice. Rav Avadia himself was controversial within the Sephardi world as well. But it talks about how that connects in strongly with the Shulchan Aruch. So one group of people said, fantastic, just what we need. Yes. Oh yes, very much before this. The question is, most of them changed allegiance to a large degree to the Shulchan Aruch, except a few, the Taimanim. There are certain groups of Yemenites who really very much go with the Rambam, the Hashkofa, the Halacha, the whole works, and they are Rambam oriented down the line. But most of the Sephardi world takes the Rambam very seriously, but at the end of the day the Shulchan Aruch is key. There was a second group of people who basically gave it a qualified approval. I would, if you like, call this the Ashkenazi response, the general Ashkenazi response. The Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, let's go to him, let's talk about him a little bit. He's in Krakow in Poland, and he is doing exactly the same thing as the Shulchan Aruch, but he doesn't realize the Shulchan Aruch is doing it. And what happens? One day, one of the Ramah students gives to the Ramah a gift and said, look, Rebbe, this book has been printed, and by the way, printed is very interesting, because one of the things that assisted in the worldwide popularity of the Sefer, the Shulchan Aruch, was the fact that the printing press had been invented just before, in the mid to late 1400s, we're now in the early 1500s, and that the only printing press in Eretz Israel was in Tzfat. And therefore, the Shulchan Aruch had ready access to this. This is like being connected to the internet when the rest of the world isn't, okay? And you can get your message out there, and therefore this was the first time really ever that a book written by a particular Rav could within a few decades be on the desk of every other Rav in the world. This has never happened before. It has to be written in manuscripts. So now you have printing. So someone gave the Ramah a gift and said, look at this, the Bet Yosef. This is just down your street. You love this kind of thing. Isn't this what you're working on as well? And the Ramah writes that he read this and he couldn't believe it. This is his life work done by somebody else and finished before he did it. And he said at first, he says this was a little bit depressing, to say the least. You're working on a project, you're putting your whole kochos into it, and you realize somebody else has already got there before you. But then he says, I thought to myself, you know something, maybe we can make a virtue out of this whole thing. And he wrote to the Shulchan Aruch, and he said to him, look, your book is phenomenal, genius. The Bet Yosef, the Shulchan Aruch, genius. But at the end of the day, you know, the Rambam, the Rif, the Rosh, it's a little bit on the Sephardi side. The Rif was clearly from the Sephardi world. The Rambam was clearly from the Sephardi world, and the Rambam and the Rif do not disagree very often. The Rambam writes in his own writings that I based my writing on the Rif, and I only disagree with the Rif on 80, which is not many, occasions. So the Rif and the Rambam are already clearly coming out of the Sephardi world. The Rosh, okay, the Rosh was Ashkenazi. He lived in Germany, but even he transited. He made a transition to Spain. He went to live in Spain. He became the Rav of Toledo, I believe, and or maybe it was Barcelona. I can't remember. You check that afterwards. And he said, "Look, this is a great idea, but it needs to be adjusted just a touch for the Ashkenazi sect. Meaning, where's Rashi? Where are the Balei HaTosfos? Where is the minhag that we follow? Have a look, please, over the page on number two. Look at what the Ramor writes. I'll do this quite quickly because there's a lot of other things that we need to talk about. Says the Ramor in his introduction to the Darchi Moshe. He wrote his own Perush on the Torah, which appears alongside the Bet Yosef on the Torah. And he says in his introduction as follows: Ki yadua she'arava machaber Bet Yosef. That the Rav Machaber, the Bet Yosef, he became known, of course, as the Bet Yosef, the Rav Yosef Karo. B'tziva Oel Agedolim Ksav U'Pasak Halacha B'Chol Makom Al Pishnayim V'Shlosha Edim. He goes according to two or three Edim, a quote from last week's Parsha as well. Heima HaGa'olim HaNechmadim HaRif HaRambam VaHarosh. He follows the Rambam, the Rambam and the Rosh. B'Chol Makom Shishnayim Mehem L'Dat Achav Netzmadim. Anytime he can get two of them to agree. U'L'Shar Ravasa Adirei HaTorah. But the other rabbis, the greats of Torah, L'Chash Aleihem. He doesn't really take any much account of them. Rak B'Makom G'dolim Amad L'Sok HaLocha K'Div Rishnayim. He just goes with his two great gedolim. The afki hein kamai, the loy batray. Even though there's no question that the Rif, the Rambam, the Rosh are the greats, they are the earlier great poskim of the Rishonim era. The loy batray, they are not the later ones. However, the loy chashlid varim shet savchu boy kamai de kamai. In doing so, the Shulchan Aruch has ignored something that even the earliest of the early authorities says is important. Halo HaRif, i.e. the Rif himself, Shepasak, who paskins b'soy perik based the erivim, the hiskimu were rabim, and most people agree with him, l'sok halacha, b'chol hamakom kebasrai. Don't we have a principle, is that if there's a conflict between the earlier and the later authorities, says the Ramah, we go with the later ones, and not the earlier ones. Meaning the later ones are more up to date. They take account of the early authorities and they bring the later minhagim in. How can you have ignored all those people? And he goes on to talk about the minhag of Ashkenaz, the Maharil, and other people. He says, we need to adjust this sefer. It's not good enough as it is. And he wrote to the Shulchan Aruch, and he said, and by the way, this is a little bit of a chutzpah, because the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Karo, was a senior poskim of the time. He was in his 60s, 70s. The Ramah was a very young man. He was in his 30s in Krakow, which was like a backwater in Poland. It wasn't the center of the Jewish age yet. And he wrote to the Shulchan Aruch and said, do you mind? I have a suggestion to make. I'd like to slightly Ashkenazify your book, and where I feel that the Ashkenazi minhag disagrees with what you've paskened, I'd like to put that in, if you don't mind. Can we make a book which is now a combination of our two approaches? And I'm not going to disagree very often, but every now and then I'd like to put something in. And very graciously, the Rav Yosef Karo, the Shulchan Aruch, wrote back and said, yes, I'm okay with that. I agree with your perspective. There could have very easily been two Shulchan Aruchs from the very beginning, and it's a great credit to the Jewish community that there wasn't two Shulchan Aruch. There weren't two Shulchan Aruch. And if you look at Ayom Hazeh, the Shulchan Aruch is now printed as two books. Look to the back page, please, on page 4. This is just a page of the first page of the standard Shulchan Aruch. It's the writing in the middle that I'm interested in, where it says right in the biggest print, sort of the top middle of the page, Hilchot Hanhagat Adam Baboker, how the halachas of how you get up in the morning, and he brings then Din Hashkamat Baboker, how do you get up in the morning, and he starts Aleph, and you see that the Shulchan Aruch always appears now in two fonts. either a bold and a non-bold, or a Rashi script and a block script. And he says, Yigaber ka'ari la'amod baboke la'avodat baro. The first halacha in Shulchan Aruch is get up in the morning, don't press snooze too many times, because when you need to get up, you need to get up. You have to have the gevura of the Ari to get up on time. By the way, one of my Rosh Yeshiva once said to me that the real gevura, the real strength of getting up in the morning like an Ari, is going to bed at night. That's the gevura. It's not the getting up in the morning, it's going to bed early enough to be able to get up in the morning. And actually that's very true. So probably the first Shulchan Aruch, first halach in Shulchan Aruch is go to bed early enough that you need to get up on time. Okay? Sheyehu ma'orer hashachar, and an ideal world, you should even wake up the morning. And it goes on, the Mefarshim talk about the idea of getting up before Nates, and etc., etc. And then you see it immediately goes into Rashi script, and this is the Ramah. This is Rav Moshe Itzlis adding in. Now on this particular page he seems to have a lot to say. This is not so typical. Usually it's a word here and a word there. And he goes on and talks about the fact that Al-Kol Panim, never, in any event, Lo Yachez Man Tfilah, don't get up too late. And he talks about other things. I'm not interested in this particular halacha. So now on every page of Shulchan Aruch, you have two books in one. And usually, I don't know about percentages exactly, I'd say it's more like 80-20. 80% Rav Yosef Karo, 20% Rav Moshe Itzlis. Again, this particular daf is a little bit unrepresentative. And now you have it, the Shulchan Aruch. And that's the book that almost everybody has accepted. And everyone else around the side came later. I'm not getting into that now. We have developed this wonderful system in Torah Sforim of having 8, 9, 10, 15, 20 books all on the same page. I'm not aware of anyone else. I've never seen anything else like this. This is genius in many ways. You can be reading 20 books all at the same time. Jews are probably the original multitaskers that you can. In fact, I read somewhere once a few years ago in Harvard, they invented a special desk for people that found it, that were very active people that they needed to learn, what have you. And they invented this desk. It's like a little tabletop on two stands. It stands on the floor, and you stand up and you hold it with your arms, and you can move it backwards and forwards and sideways. Like Harvard reinvented this whole new table for people who were all hyperactive. And at the end of the day, they just invented the Stender, therefore we don't read one book at a time and sit in one place. We read 25 books at a time and jump all over the place. That's how we learn. So if you like, that is the second approach, that the book needs to just be tweaked and Ashkenazified, and now we have a Psak Halacha that suits everybody. However, there was a third approach, and with this I want to spend the last 10 minutes of the Shir. The third approach was less friendly. Because there were a group of people, mostly in the Ashkenazi world, who turned round to the Shulchan Aruch and looked at the project with some level of horror and said, this is how you pass an halacha. How does that work? The way you pass an halacha is you become a Talmudic genius, you learn the whole Talmud from beginning to end and all the commentaries, and then you reach your own conclusion. And if you are not qualified to master the Talmud, so you ask somebody else who is. And they pasken however they feel. That's how we pasken halacha. Not how they feel in a feeling sense. It's a work of great scholarship. But what you don't do is pick three random people and then make some majority argument. Majority is out of 71. That's how the Sanhedrin works. 36, 35, that's a majority. 51, 20, that's a majority. 2 out of 3. First of all, you pick the three. And therefore, who's to say that they are the three? Okay, I agree, they are the three most likely candidates for the three greats of the Rishonim. But you pick the three, and they all happen to be very Sephardi. And then you said 2 out of 3 is the majority, like Mapitoma, how can this work? And if you look, one of the leading, in the vanguard of this approach is the Yamshel Shlomo. The Yamshel Shlomo is Rav Shlomo Luria, who lived in Poland at the same time as the Ramah, and he doesn't react in the way that the Ramah reacted. He reacts much more negatively. Look at number 4. Ki chadash, mikaro, bali yadenu sefer. We have just seen this new sefer, the chibur she'asa mareinu harav Rav Yosef ala Turim. So Rav Yosef Karo ala Turim. And by the way, nobody is doubting the qualification of Rav Yosef Karo as an individual. He was unequivocally the greatest authority of the time. But he says, we've come across this new book. Okay? V'harakama chidushim. He presents many chidushim. Misvarim hakadmonim from the earliest svarim. Shelo'i hayu biyadayim biyamim sha'avru. By the way, he said many some of the research that Rav Yosef Karo did, he found new manuscripts that we never really had before. There was a certain amount of, I wouldn't call it academic, but there was a certain amount of research project going on there. We never had a lot of that stuff. Uchuvas nachrios, and strange new tshuvas. Chidushim asher nimtzu b'chol asvarim, as well as chidushim which are in others for him. He didn't leave anything out. He was very, very thorough. He's almost left no way to be opposed to this. He's been so comprehensive. Aval, however, Asa Psharas, he's made a lot of compromises. From his own view. Umisvarat hakeres. What's Svarat HaKeres?
Gut feeling.
Gut feeling. He's kind of gone for the boich svaras. I don't know boich svaras, but like he it's like the two out of three. But right pamim the Issa the Heta, and many times in Halacha, in Issa the Heta, negid HaKabbalah. He doesn't mean against the Kabbalah in terms of the mystical Kabbalah, but against the received psak, against the minak. Ashekibanu v'nagnu, v'nagnu adheina. What about the way we've been doing things up till now? What if we don't paskin like any of your three? What if we paskin like Tosfos in Hilchos, for example, in meat and milk, like we said before? Are we not allowed to have our own minagim anymore? The Talmidim, and today's younger generation of Talmidim, holchim achad dvarav upsakav, they follow his book. It's wonderful. The lo yadu, and they don't realize shebenachshamhu, how dangerous this is. Shehu ichriya kama pamim neged haTosfos. He often goes against the Tosfos. The haPoskim asher anu noagim lisak kavatehem kavatayhu, and we often follow these poskim that he just ignores. The hine shagu bezeh. People are making a major error following this. Ma'achas sheral shekain kosav v'sifro. They see what's written in his book. Shekach halacha. This is the halacha. Amru, and they say kach kosav hakaru lehedya. This is explicitly written in the Shulchan Aruch. Ki kach ha'inyan harash alifneihem. But this is not a good thing. Mashikosav b'seifi yaminu. They believe what they read in a book. How can you believe what you read in somebody else's book? Im yamod acher echad. And if somebody else was to stand up, chay v'tzaveich kakruke, and crying and screaming like a cockerel, meaning opposing this, she'ein hadin came, and that they oppose the psak of the Shulchan Aruch. Beraya's gemuras, and they can bring good halachic talmudic proofs. Or a filupa Kabbalah, or they can bring a clear tradition. They don't take any attention to this person anymore. They just go to the art scroll equivalent of the time. They look it up. Nothing wrong with art scroll. I'm a big fan of art scroll in many ways, but you can't just look something up in a quick kitzer, quick guide to the halachas of.
No shortcuts.
You know, and he says you can't do that. Especially today, he makes a very kind of cutting comment. For our many sins, nismachim merubim. There are many people with smicha, but very few people who know what they're talking about. Interesting. Lots of rabbis, but not many chachomim. And because of that, he says, toifsin divrei hasefer. They jump on this book. Okay, Asher Matsu, Kol HaChidushim does all their work for them. Ubezeh Hushfu HaKetanim LeGidolim, and now everyone's the same. Small people, big people, Na'arim, young people without experience, Lezikain. Everyone's on the same page now. It's like crowdsourcing. You can just look it up on the internet. You put it in a search and you know the halacha. This was the equivalent feeling at the time. And he says in number 5, the Lozeh HaDerech, this is not the way. The Lozeh HaIr, this is not our approach. Ki b'yamos Ravina v'Ravashi, from the days of the Gemara, Ein Kabbalah Lisok Ka'echad Min HaGa'onim. We don't paskin like any one person. That's not how it works anymore. Or Min HaAchronim, whether they're earlier or later. Ela Mishe Yichshu Dvarav, somebody who is qualified to do so. V'yosam Yusadim B'moifes Choytech Al Pi HaTalmud HaYushalmi HaTosefta B'mokim She'en HaKhrov Talmud. Meaning, what you do now is you become a Talmudic genius. That's how you paskin halacha. You don't look it up in a book. And if you can't become a Talmudic genius, okay, fine. So you don't pretend that you know how to paskin. You go to a poisek, who does know how to paskin, and that's how we paskin halacha. He says, I'm not having any of this, I don't agree with it, and I don't want it. Looking number six, the Marashah, also from the 16th century, from Poland, Rav Adolf, and he says as follows. Ubudoras halalu, in our generation, he says, there are some people who pass them from the Shulchan Aruch. They don't know what they're talking about. Unless they learn it from the Gemara, how do they know? They're just reading it from a book. Learning the Gemara is how you are Meshamish Tamid Chachamim. It's how you learn how to paskin. The Tals Nafu Bahira Saman. Therefore, they're making mistakes. They're paskining wrong. They're destroying the world. You have to stop this. We have to stop it now. These people are not paskining correctly. And the Bach in number 7 and number 8 says something very, very similar. Number 7 says the Bach is also from slightly later, but from Poland, Rav Yol Sirkus. Says Shuvah Kfar Yadata She'oisan Hanishim Nishim Shachim Lahoiras Hara Al Pi HaShulchan Aruch. Those people who choose to pass in accordance to the Shulchan Aruch, Heim Hamorim B'Torah Shaloi Kehalacha. They are not passing according to the Halacha. Ki Lo Yod Ushorish Shel Hara. They don't know the roots. They don't know the background to the halachic process. They just pass coming for the Shulchan Aruch, and you can bring many other examples. And I just bring your attention on the last page, to number 9. I'm not going to read the whole thing because we're coming to the end of the shiur. But the Maharal of Prague, who is of course very well known from this period as well, again from the 16th century, he says again that at the end of the day, Psak Halacha has to be a process of cognition. It has to be a process of understanding the Talmudic presentation, even to the point, look at the words I've underlined in the second paragraph, Ki Yose Roy V'Yose Nachon. It's actually better and more correct She'yia Poisek Mitocha Talmud, that a person paskins from the Talmud, obviously if they're qualified. Even though, maybe he'll get it wrong. Maybe he will reach a conclusion which is not actually the accurate conclusion. And he won't pass in the din in its true emet. And the hara will not be the correct tzak. At the end of the day, he says, you're better off, obviously, if you're qualified. If you're not qualified, what business do you have trying to be a poisek? But if you are qualified to a poisek, you're better off doing it the right way, even though you may get the wrong sack, wrong quotes and quotes, in the sense of the objective truth, and we talked about a bit about this earlier in the course, than just looking it up in a book, which is not at all the way to paskin halacha. And therefore, this was the third approach, which was very unhappy about the modern day change that was introduced by the Rambam and Shulchan Aruch. However, in terms of the historical acceptance of Klal Yisrael, clearly this approach has not succeeded. The Jewish people as a whole have accepted the Shulchan Aruch. Qualifying, however, that statement, I would say that within the Ashkenazi world, there are from time to time those poskim with broad enough shoulders to ultimately turn around and take this last approach and say, I don't feel bound by the Shulchan Aruch. It's rare in the Sephardi world that you'll get someone that says that, but someone like, for example, Rav Moshe Feinstein, if you read his tshuvas, for him the Shulchan Aruch is very important, but not binding. And he'll go right over the head of the Shulchan Aruch, back into the Rishonim, and even back into the Talmud, to bring out his own psak, even if that goes against the Shulchan Aruch from time to time. The Gro was the same. The Gro, the Vilna Gaon, did not feel himself bound by the psak of the Shulchan Aruch, and they're really the inheritors, if you like, of this last approach, but this is few and far. These are few and far between, and now the Jewish people has either entirely or largely accepted the Shulchan Aruch as psak. I would say one last word, which is all the other opinions which are out there, which didn't find their way into the psak, where are they? All the other Rishonim that I mentioned, the Ramban and the Rashba and the Tosfos and the Rashi, etc. The answer is they're all still out there, and they are minority opinions, and they therefore become the framework of what we today call Chumras, following an opinion which didn't make it into the Shulchan Aruch, which is nevertheless an opinion out there, or Kulas. And how you apply chumras and kulas is an entire shiur in and of itself, because you can't just grab any old minority opinion because you looked it up in a book and you found it there and say, oh, let's follow this, either to be machmir or to be meikul. That's not how it works. There has to be a system to how chumras and kulas work, and our modern day Jewish world sometimes has an issue with that. Either people are very keen to jump on chumras, or people on the other extreme are very keen to find minority opinions that say, oh look, you can do this and do that and the other. And the answer is, you have to have a holistic picture as to how that all comes together, but we for sure don't have time to talk about that today. We will have, therefore, to leave now our discussion of Torah text and transmission with the Shulchan Aruch and the modern day halachic process. Where the halacha will go in the future, that's another discussion, which is interesting as to what will happen when Mashiach comes to the halachic process. That itself is a major debate within the Rishonim and the Achronim, but for that we'll have to wait, Bezrat Hashem, for another series. Therefore, thank you very much for coming. I hope it's been enlightening on some level. Thank you very much. We will continue next week on Wednesday, Bezrat Hashem, with a new series in Ben Adam HaChaverah.
Have a wonderful day. Yeah, next week. Not tomorrow, but next week, next Wednesday.
I didn't stop it either.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I can't say that.